All right, welcome everyone. Good to see you tonight. And I want to do just a couple of introductory remarks, have a prayer, and then we'll get right into our lesson. What you need to understand is this lesson tonight is a science lecture. I know you came to do that with me tonight. And I have some rules about that. First of all, I don't allow sleeping. And I'm watching you. Second, we're going to give our attention to information about the natural world. And so I want to start with this passage. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. It is the theme passage for tonight and for the rest of this month. On Wednesday nights, you're going to have lectures about evidences from the natural world. I will do the first two, and Todd Chandler will do the last two. But both of us will be taking an approach that is not like your typical Bible class. So please don't take offense at that, because this passage teaches that the invisible attributes of God can be clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. That is the title of our theme this month. Being understood by the things that are made. What that passage teaches is there's no excuse. I want to read it to you verbatim. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. That passage teaches you should be able to learn there's a God who's eternally powerful, and he's not part of nature. He's divine. That you should be able to learn from examining things that are made. Well, folks, that's what science is about. In fact, science is the best thing man has ever invented to study things that are made. And so we're going to turn our attention to science, which testifies things have been made. And if things have been made, they were designed. And so this is the classic argument from design. I'm convinced always the strongest argument for the existence of God in the natural world. But the reason I start with this verse is because everyone in this audience, I suspect, is a Bible believer. And when you come to a Bible class, you expect to use the Bible. And that's not negative at all. But I'm telling you tonight that the Bible tells us the natural world is another testimony of God. And so we're going to be turning our attention to God's other book, the book of the natural world. So I hope you'll stay with me for this and that you will be back each evening, because these lessons go together. So thank you for being here. That's all we're going to do by way of introduction. Let's have a word of prayer. Our great God in heaven, we are so grateful to be together tonight in this quiet place, a place of no problems and trouble, a place where we can turn our attention to high and holy things, spiritual things, and learn both from your word and from your world. Bless us toward the end that this evening we will leave here with a deeper appreciation of your majesty, your glory, your eternal power, the great God who is our creator. We thank you and we praise you in the name of Jesus, and amen. Science, as it we have in our modern world, really became evident in the 1600s to 1800s in the Renaissance. And most of the men who studied in those days and who were the scientists who developed modern day science were believers in God, in Jesus Christ, and in the Bible. I would tell you that I'm not certain science would have arisen had it not been for Christianity. And there are all kinds of reasons for that. It's in the Western world, in the Renaissance, that this whole notion developed. And there were a number of things they had to overcome in order for that to happen. But the great majority of Christians who were scientists spoke openly about that. And they would clearly proclaim their conviction that the testimony of the natural world was there's a God. So What I thought I'd do tonight first is build a little bit of historical background, and then I want to talk to you about some things that have unfolded in our century in the last 75 years that are absolutely astounding about the God we serve. Before I do that, though, I want to say that in every generation, God has given sufficient evidence in the world to convince any reasonable person that He exists. And the things I'm going to talk to you about primarily this morning were not known in the previous centuries. It is my conviction that because of an onslaught of atheists in our time, who are evangelistic, by the way, God has provided us an open door into things we never knew before, and it's almost like He said, "What are you going to do with this, you unbelievers?" And I'm convinced that our young people today need more evidence that's more powerful to help them see that the natural world also testifies to God. So I went through some of this myself, young folks in this audience. I'm not young anymore. But I went through this period of the last 60 to 70 years. It's exciting times, but also very challenging. And many have lost their faith during those days. And part of it's because of the approach that scientists take to this. So, let's talk a little bit about that. I hope you're going to help me here. By the way, my third rule about having a class in science is I want class participation. I'm not going to pick on any one person, but I am going to expect you to help and be involved because it helps keep you with me. So I'll test you out in a minute. We'll try something. Johann Kepler, how many in this room have ever heard of him? Raise your hand. Well, that's pretty good. We have a group of folks that have more knowledge about some of this past history than a lot of places I've been. Johann Kepler is one of the most famous astronomers of that period. Great mathematician. And he would tell you not only does the natural world testify of God, but mathematics itself is a grand testimony that there is a God. Because math came before matter, and math comes from mind, and mind is God. And so he gladly and openly proclaimed that what I'm doing in mathematics is thinking God's thoughts after him. If you've ever studied calculus, I taught that for about 40 years. And most of the time, Cal won. And what my young people were to learn is that every day in calculus, we're thinking God's thoughts after him. Because in calculus, you're studying infinity class, and you'll never get closer to thinking God's thoughts after him than when you're thinking about infinity. And so the next man, you familiar with this one? I hope everybody would raise your hand for this one. He's only the greatest scientist that ever lived. He's credited with inventing the calculus. Was that a good lead-in? And not only did he invent it, he told us how to use it to solve thousands of practical problems. He also invented the classical laws of physics and of motion. He is the one that discovered the law of gravity class. I know all of you have studied that somewhere along the line. The famous equation, force equals G, which is the gravitational constant, times mass 1 times mass 2 divided by D squared. I know you all remember that. That's called the inverse square law. Isaac Newton's the first man that discovered that about the natural world. And what you don't know is, once that law was established in our minds and in our mathematics, it can then be used to predict what's going to happen in the natural world. So his law of gravity is used all the time in our space program. You think he knew one thing about space and how to go send spaceships out there? No, but he knew about the universal law of gravity and gave it to mankind. We'll come back to that in a little bit. So these are two of the most famous of that period of time. And if you were there in college in the early 1800s, you would have taken this class. It's called Natural Theology. Or if you'll read with me the subtitle, or Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity Collected from the Appearances of Nature, by William Paley. So we have a bunch of college kids in this class, it looks to me like. Had you been in college in the early 1800s in England or in Europe, you would have taken a course on natural theology. Every student was required to take that. And its own purpose was to testify to the appearances of deity, how deity is proclaimed in the natural world. Well, I can't teach that class tonight, but I do have the book if you want to borrow it. And there's a new edition of it that's been reprinted. It's well worth your read. But that's just three. I have a book here by a gentleman named Henry Schaeffer. Let me ask again, how many in this room ever heard of Henry Schaeffer? Two. That's probably right. But he's one of the foremost physical chemists of our time. And this book is called Science and Christianity, Conflict or Coherence. This man gives lectures all over the world on how science and religion are not in conflict, and how, in fact, science testifies to the existence of God. He's a firm believer in God and in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. And this book is full of other scientists of the same ilk, even in our day. So don't you ever let somebody tell you that there are a massive number of believers who are well-respected, published scientists of our time. Get this book if you're not convinced. So how is it, class, with that background of modern science in the 16 to 1800s, that in our generation, in the 20th century, we have the Cosmos series by Carl Sagan, in which the first statement in that physics series, that astronomy series, that's been the most watched science series on television in the history of mankind. Here's how it started. The cosmos is all that is, or was, or ever will be. Ladies and gentlemen, that is not a science statement. That is a statement of philosophy. Sagan believes with all his heart that that's the case. The cosmos is all there is. Sagan, if he were still alive today, would have seen some things that go against that in the sciences, about which I'm going to speak in a few minutes. But here we are in the 20th century. By that time, some 200 years later, the majority of scientists around the world believe in a naturalistic, materialistic view of how things came about. It's called scientific materialism. It's taken over, folks. So how is that? I'll give you a very brief and quick history of science to just give you an idea of how this developed over time. Pierre Simon de Laplace, 1749 to 1827, he considered himself the next great Isaac Newton. I would suggest he was far from it. But here's what he said. Nature, with its matter, energy, and forces, could produce and maintain our solar system. There is no need for a God hypothesis. I want to read you what Newton said in his most famous work, The Principia. He said, "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." Capital B. That's in the General Scholium of the Principia, his greatest work, as he proclaimed openly, this could not have come about without a good designer. That's Isaac Newton. This is Pierre Simon de Laplace, as he moved us away from that notion. We don't need a God hypothesis. And then Charles Lyell came along in geology, an attempt to explain the former changes in the Earth's surface by reference to causes now in operation. His whole philosophy was, you can develop a theory about the past by examining the present, and you don't need God. So you don't need God in the solar system. You don't need God in geological formations. And then along came Charles Darwin in 1859 and wrote his text on the origin of species by means of natural selection. And have you read the subtitle, class? Or the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. I'm pausing to let that sink in just a little bit. That man's book in 1859 has had a greater impact on humans than any other text other than the Bible, in my judgment. Because he has allowed people in their own minds to be intellectually fulfilled atheists. Because they think he's provided a natural explanation for how all living things got here. And so you don't need God there either. So one by one, God has been removed in the sciences, according to many of these folks. And as a result of that, he was removed also from college classrooms and high school classrooms. You see, Darwin said there's no need for a designer to account for the origin of species of life. Natural selection, acting on natural variation, accounts for all the life forms and the appearance of design. It looks like it's designed, but it isn't. And that was Darwin's theory that swept the world and still dominates the scientific worldview. So how is that possible? Well, men change their minds, and they blame it partly on what they've learned about the natural world. And so in 1959, there was a 100-year celebration of the Darwin theory. It was a Darwinian year. And I was alive then. Raise your hand if you were alive in 1959. Make me feel better. I don't know if any of you saw some of the celebrations of Darwin in 1959, but it was over the top as to how amazing he was and how wonderful. And I was getting ready to go into college in those days. And I'll just take a little sidelight here with you. It was common in those days in public universities for scientists to say to you students, if there's any believers in God in this classroom, you best get over it. Because the more we learn about the natural world, and we're learning a lot, the less we need God. God, after all, is the person you put in places where you don't know. They called him the God of the gaps. And so what you're going to find out, class, these teachers would tell me and others, is your belief is part of the Middle Ages, doesn't belong in the modern world. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing tonight, class, with you, because that notion is still very much alive. And the four horsemen of the modern day new atheists, you know these guys? Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and the most hateful of them all, Richard Dawkins, the public professor, the professor of the public knowledge of science education at Oxford University. And he must have had a bad experience with religion, because he has no use for it. And he will publicly proclaim that folks who believe it are deluded. That's what we're facing, class, in this generation. So I love to talk about some things that'll help us revisit the argument from design. So that's the background. So I'm asking you, class, are you ready for some science? Your answer is yes. Okay, good. Here's a book I want to recommend to you at the very beginning of this particular lecture. Stephen Meyer is one of the best writers I know in our modern day for scientific material. He's outstanding. He's written three great books. This is the third. It's called The Return of the God Hypothesis. That's why I quoted Simon de Laplace, because he's the one that was brazen enough to say, we don't need the God hypothesis anymore. Meyer says, this century has declared a return of the God hypothesis. And he says there are three scientific discoveries that reveal the mind behind the universe. And here they are. The evidence has become overwhelmingly strong in the natural world. Folks, this is not coming from the Bible. This is coming from the evidence of science about the natural world. May I add here, I do not expect you to believe this because I said it. I will tell you where I got it, because I didn't do any of this thing originally. You can go look for yourself. I challenge you, especially you young folks, examine this for yourself and be convinced that the natural world is given a grand testimony for a great and amazing God. And here's the first piece of it. The evidence of the natural world nowadays in the sciences is that there was a beginning. You remember what Sagan said? The cosmos, all there is, all there ever was, or ever there will, ever will be. Typical atheists want matter to be eternal. Then you don't have to explain how it got started. They believe matter's eternal, and matter then produced everything else you see by natural causes. If nature, space, time, and matter had a beginning, that is highly problematic for an atheist. And some of them, they just have openly expressed how, no, they don't like it at all. But the evidence is so strong you can't deny it. This is not my lecture for tonight, so I'm going to point number two. But there are books in my bibliography which I'm going to provide the folks here if you want to follow them and read them about that. The second great scientific discovery of this last 75 years is that the universe, our solar system, and Earth are remarkably fine-tuned to support life on Earth and have been since the beginning. Fine-tuning, class, is one of the most powerful modern-day arguments. Somebody did this. This did not come about by natural causes. So we're going to focus on that one tonight at the macroscopic level, and God willing, next Wednesday night at the microscopic level. So let's talk a little bit about that, but here's the third one. Even the simplest forms of life at the biochemical level contain massive amounts of digital information being used to produce and maintain an untold number of molecular machines and complex processes. And I just lost you, didn't I? What that's saying, class, is nature is full of information in digital format in every living thing. And in addition to that, there's little machines running around inside every cell in your body doing amazing things, about which we'll also speak, God willing, next Wednesday night. But tonight I want to turn your attention to the larger universe. So I start with Paul Davies' little book called The Goldilocks Enigma. Now everybody's met, I mean, you know Goldilocks, and he picked her for a reason. She went out into the woods, right? Help me, class. And she went into the home of the... That was weak. She went into the home of the... Yes, thank you. And when she got inside, she got to the table and she sat down and had a bite of porridge. And the first porridge was too hot. So she went around to the next one and it was too cold. And she went to the third one and it was... That's the answer to my question for the next 10 minutes. And you didn't do well with it at all. The third bowl of porridge was? Let me try one more time. I've heard more enthusiasm out of half this crowd. The third bowl of porridge was? Yeah, I want some enthusiasm because that's what we're going to see everywhere in the universe. That's why he calls it the Goldilocks Enigma. An enigma is a mystery. He can't figure it out. We can. It's not an enigma when you believe in God. But he says some interesting things in his little book, and Paul Davies, though he's an atheist, is pretty honest about this. So he says, for example, one of the most significant facts, arguably the most significant fact about the universe, is that we're a part of it. Well, I hope you'd agree with that. How did we get here? It's amazing. Then he says, everyone agrees that the universe looks as if it was designed for life. You see how he highlighted looks there? And then he spends the next 300 pages trying to convince you it really wasn't. But it sure looks like it. And then here's another statement he makes in an interview he had on the Anthropic Principle. The really amazing thing is not that life on earth is balanced on a knife edge, but that the entire universe is balanced on a knife edge and would be total chaos if any of the natural constants were even off slightly. That's an enigma class. And he would tell you, sciences are in agreement about this. Now, for most of my time this evening, I'm going to treat you like my jury. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm trying to convince you of my case. And I'm telling you, this is a situation where both the defense and the prosecuting attorney believe the same things. What we differ on is how to interpret it. But nobody disagrees with what I'm about to tell you. The fact is, if any of these constants and a host of other things are off by just one little teensy bit, that means they are not. Then we wouldn't be here. These things are absolutely essential for living things to exist on a planetary system like we're in. And everybody knows it. So what does it mean? So let me give you a little bit of history here. In the 1960s, when I was in college, we had discovered some 12 characteristics of the cosmos and our solar system fine-tuned to make human life possible. 12. So ladies and gentlemen in the jury, if I were trying to convince you something didn't happen by accident, that it happened by somebody purposefully doing it, would 12 coincidences convince you? Maybe, because that's a lot of coincidences. We haven't touched the hem of the garment class. That was in the 1960s. Here's the updated information. In 2020, there are at least 50 books that have been published about the anthropic principle. And that is about things that are necessary to have life here on this earth. Hugh Ross and his staff took those 50 books, collected it all together, and they cataloged over 800 finely tuned characteristics as essential for any potential human life site in the observable universe. Now, there are folks that argue with his 800. There may be some overlap, and some of those may duplicate. So let's just back it off about 300. I'm telling you, there's at least 500 different characteristics that all have to be, say it again, just right, or you wouldn't be here. Neither would any life forms be here. Now, I'm telling you, you don't have to believe me, but this guy says it, who's an atheist, and a lot of others who are atheists and believers say the same thing. So what are some of them? Well, I love this example. You probably don't know John Polkinghorne. He has his degree in physics from Trinity in Oxford. He was a professor of mathematical physics at the University of Cambridge in England. Very prestigious role. He later became a priest in the Anglican Church, and he won the Templeton Prize for researching how science and religion agree. He's a great mathematician and scientist and a good thinker. You ought to read after him, young people. But if he were teaching this class tonight, here's one of the things he'd say to you. Suppose, in fact, why don't I just read you a little bit of that. He's quoted in this book I brought to your attention at the beginning, because Stephen Meyer was actually in one of his classes. He said Polkinghorne would ask students to imagine that they had traveled deep into space and had entered a space station where they found a universe-creating machine. And you see his rough sketch of that. The very machine responsible for the fine-tuning of the universe. Polkinghorne would ask his audience to imagine that this hypothetical universe-generating machine displayed a number of different dials. You see the dials on there? And knobs and sliders, each one representing one of the many cosmological fine-tuning parameters. I don't know if you can see those up there. I want to read a few of them to you. The strong nuclear force, let's go back. The strong nuclear force is that knob. The initial entropy of the universe is that dial. The mass of neutrinos is this one. The gravitational force constant, that's that G in Newton's gravity, universal gravity law. We'll come back to that one in just a minute. And here's the expansion rate of the universe, the cosmological constant. Folks, that dial here ought to have 500 different knobs and slides. And the fact is, every one of them is set. He said, what if you imagined that those dials had to be fixed in a specific setting out of the vast number of possibilities? Every one of them had to be set. Exactly right. So how just right did it have to be? Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I'm going to go another book that I'd sure recommend to you. If you haven't studied this material at all, you start with this one. It's called God's Crime Scene by J. Warner Wallace. May I introduce you to him? He's a cold case detective. So somebody tell me what that is. You know what that is, a cold case detective? Yeah, he has to take over a case that nobody could figure out because it's gotten cold. And that's what he does for a living. He was raised by an atheist father, and he himself became a believer because of this material, the science. And he wrote this book in hopes of converting his daddy. As far as I'm aware, his daddy has yet to become a believer, but he's still working on him. But it's a book written at the common folks level, and it's just rich because he writes it as if he were a detective examining a crime scene, only he's using the whole universe as his crime scene. So every chapter in this book is a testimony of a case he solved. So class, I'm looking at you. You still seem to be pretty awake. I'm going to read you a little bit out of this book. Don't you lose me, because it's not bedtime stories. Helen knew something was wrong when her daughter Carrie failed to answer the door. This is chapter 2, labeled Tampering with the Evidence. It was a bright summer afternoon. Carrie said she'd be home, and her car was indeed parked in the driveway. Helen tried to peek in through the living room window, but the curtains were unusually drawn. Carrie never locked the back door, but when Helen walked into the backyard of the old house, she found the door locked and all the windows closed. This wasn't like Carrie. At least one badly worn window was always open. Not this time. Helen began to panic. She knew Todd and Carrie had a tumultuous marriage, one that included physical violence. Todd had moved out, but Helen still feared for her daughter's safety. You see, the couple had a child named Lexi, but the violence had only intensified since her birth. A week ago, Todd had threatened to kill Carrie, and just last night, Carrie confided to her mama there had been yet another fight. When Helen could not get Carrie to answer the door this afternoon, she called the police. Now, I don't have time to read you all the details, but I can tell you he won the case and convicted Todd of first-degree murder of his own wife and daughter. And here were some of the facts that came to play as they learned more about that scene. There was a pocket door at the bottom of the stairwell. And by the way, the house was so full of gas, they had to get out of there first and clean the air. Pocket door was closed, and it was stuffed with clothes at the bottom of it. Carrie would never have allowed that, folks. There was a door to the master bedroom upstairs, and it was closed with a pile of laundry laying against the bottom of the door. The wall separating the bedroom from the upstairs hallway was retrofitted with a gas heater, and the pilot light was out, but the valve was on full blast. The last straw was this. When they checked with the gas company, they had turned the gas off because of lack of payment. 2 days before these two precious ladies died, Todd went down and paid for it and opened the gas again. And they called in the detectives. Nobody saw Todd murder his wife and daughter. But the consistent evidence, the circumstantial evidence, added up with such certainty that the jury unanimously convicted of both murders. Then he goes on to say this: we were compelled in that case to examine evidence of tampering because of one important fact. There were two dead bodies in that house. In a similar way, when we look at the nature of our universe, the existence of living bodies provokes an investigation. Like our murder scene, there were foundational, regional, and locational conditions that demand explanation. The foundational laws of physics, the regional properties of our solar system, and the locational conditions of our planet itself all resulted in our being able to be here. But did this have to be the case? You see, what this detective does is, if you're looking in a house and you're seeing a scene, there's two dead bodies, there's only certain possibilities. There is either a natural cause for their death, some kind of an accident, or they were murdered. So what you look for is, could you explain that death in that house without leaving the house? Or does the evidence add up that somebody had to come in there and tamper with stuff? That's what you do. If circumstances had been just slightly different in Carrie's house, no one would have died that night. The conditions had to be just so in order for there to be death. In a similar way, class, in this living world, conditions had to be just so, or there would be no living creatures. A much more important question. And so he sets about to try to answer that, as a detective would. So, let's do a little bit. He first looks at foundational facts. A foundational fact in that case with Carrie and Todd is that he threatened his own wife. He was a mean guy. They had a terrible relationship. Doesn't that undergird if you're going to go to a jury with this? Well, of course. That's the first thing you talk about. He was a mean dude. He hit her. Well, these foundational constants about the universe, that's where you start. And there's a bunch of them, class. Hundreds of them. Are you with me? Every one of them on that dial, you remember, has to be set carefully. I want to talk to you about one. I'm telling you, there are hundreds. I want to talk to you about G, the gravitational constant. The fact is, if that value for G that Newton discovered were changed by one part over 1 × 10⁴, I just lost you, didn't I? 10⁴, that's 10 with 34 zeros after it. That's the denominator that divides into the number 1. Would you say that's a teensy number? I'm telling you, class, it is a fact. If G varied that much, there would be no planets. Period. It has to be that precise. And there are hundreds of them just like that. And he quotes those in here, several of them. So I'm going to leave foundational now and go to regional. What about the region in which we live? Well, we live in a galaxy. Somebody tell me, what's the name of our galaxy? Say it out loud. Milky Way. I don't know how much you know about it, but there are several types of galaxies. We happen to live in one of them. And you know this space telescope that went up just a couple of years ago? James Webb? You guys ready back there? I want to say just a word about this. This thing has taken pictures that we have never been privileged to see before, because it sees farther out into the universe. So I'm going to read you something that NASA put out before our president presented the first picture that they released to the public. Here's the NASA announcement. So, everybody's eyes on me. If you took, this is on their thing here, the web's image is approximately the size of a grain of sand held at arm's length. I've got a grain of sand in my hand, and I'm going to hold it out here at arm's length. The amount of the universe blocked by that little grain of sand is what this picture is going to be that I'm going to show you next. Did I get it across to you? Was that a teensy piece of the universe? And what you're going to see is what James Webb Telescope showed us that we'd never seen before in that one little piece of the universe. So lights out, please. Was that the first bell, by the way? That's terrible. All right, can you get those others off? Yeah, good. I'd like the rest of those, but those guys have to be able to see back there. So, okay, here we go. There it is. That's called Galaxy Cluster SMACS 0723 class. You see these things here? You say, isn't that amazing how many stars there are out there? No, class, that is a galaxy that probably has 100 billion stars in it. That's another one and another one. Most of these blobs are galaxies. You see that one right there? That's a spiral galaxy you're looking at head on. Most of these look like some other kind of galaxies. Is it a surprise to Bible believers that there are a lot of stars? Well, I hope not. The Bible speaks of it all the time. We haven't touched how many stars are out there. There's a lot. And James Webb is opening a whole new world to us. All right, let's get the lights back on. There are three basic types of galaxies: elliptical, irregular, and spiral. And I will tell you, everybody knows in those other kinds of galaxies, you couldn't have a planetary system like this with life on it. It wouldn't survive. It has to be a spiral galaxy. Guess where we live? In a spiral galaxy. It's an interesting coincidence. That's not the end of the story. In a spiral galaxy, it has to have the right location for your solar system, or it wouldn't exist. So here's a sideways picture of a spiral galaxy. Where in all of that galaxy, this is the big bulb in the middle, the sun and its planetary system could not exist in here or most of the rest of the space. In fact, there are only two spaces, right out here and right out here, where a solar system with life on it could exist in our galaxy. And that's like 1/150th of the total volume. So that means most of that galaxy is eliminated as a place where life could be. Isn't that an interesting coincidence? Our sun and its planetary system is right in there. And there's several things about that that add three or four more very narrowly changed things. You can't change them much. We're skipping a whole bunch of stuff, is what I'm telling you. What about the right kind of star? Well, our sun, of course, is perfect for us. So I've got our sun up here with the planets. It's a whole lot bigger than we are, isn't it? And size matters, but I want you to note that our sun, compared to Sirius and Pollux and Arcturus, is this little right here. And I'm not finished, because if you add Aldebaran and Betelgeuse and Antares, and our sun is right there. Can you see it? No, you cannot, because it's only one pixel. Our sun is not by far the most massive star in the universe. It's right here. There's a bunch of stars bigger, and there's a bunch of stars smaller. It is, in fact, in terms of size, it's a just right average star. But folks, there are 16 other things about our sun that are important. Its temperature, its radiation, and a host of other things, all of which have to be just right. So we're adding up coincidences, are we not? We just happen to have the right kind of a star. But the planet's important too. Here are our planets. How many out of these have life on them? One. This one. I don't have time to talk about the rest of them. Most of them, and there's no way life could exist. Where are they looking for life, class? Mars. They ain't found it yet. So I'm getting close to being finished. There's also proper mass, spin, tilt, moon, atmosphere, and crust. There's all about biochemicals, DNA, proteins, etc. There's cells and genetic codes and molecular machines down at this micro level. That's next Wednesday. Don't miss it. Because we have not touched the veritable hem of the garment class. The cell is incredible. So here's the truth. Science shows us that everywhere you look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things look like they're made. They look like they were fine-tuned to support life here on Earth. That's a fact. We see evidence of a grand designer everywhere, says Michael Behe. So is it reasonable to believe in God in this class, in this scientific age class? It's more reasonable than it's ever been in the history of mankind. And folks don't know it. Now you know a little more, and I hope you'll investigate yourself and become in awe of the amazing God that we serve. Thank you for your kind attention. Nobody fell asleep. You were good. You get an A for that.